Hello, and welcome to the podcast of MoralApologetics.com. As always, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument because it has the power to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. This week, we are finishing up a two-part series with Dr. David Baggett on the failure of secular ethical theories to explain human value and dignity. Last week, Dr. Baggett surveyed a wide array of secular ethical theories and explained why none of the theories considered could ground human value. This week, we take aim at the views of Eric Weilenberg. Dr. Weilenberg is a top-notch atheist moral realist philosopher, and his new book, Robust Ethics, is a serious piece of philosophy. Nevertheless, Dr. Baggett has some objections about Weilenberg's views as it relates to human value, and we'll be hearing those objections this week. And with that, we'll head back over to the seminary here in Lynchburg, Virginia, to hear what Dr. David Baggett has to say about Weilenberg's account of human value and dignity.
All right. So Weilenberg's view is an interesting one. He's something of a Platonist, but he's also really close to being a naturalist, right? Uh-huh. He embraces this notion of causal closure, which says that everything that happens in the physical world is caused to happen
right.
by something in the physical world, right? So if there is something like, you know, a moral property that's out there in some sense or other, it's going to, and I'll explain this in a second, supervene on the physical world, right?
Yep.
But it itself is not going to have any kind of causal impact on the physical world. It functions epiphenomenally in this way, right? So the physical world will produce it, but the causal direction won't go in the other way. It won't go the other way. Now, this makes him something of a Platonist because he does think that moral properties obtain that are not natural properties, but that they do depend for their existence on natural properties. Moral properties depend on the natural properties. And again, the fancy word for this that philosophers use is supervenience. So he thinks the various moral properties, including something like human dignity, I imagine, uh-huh. is going to supervene on natural properties, like being human.
Okay? Right.
Which, by the way, is a little controversial, right? Because that assumes that being human is a purely natural property.
Right.
And again, as we saw before, I don't think that's necessarily the case at all. So we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, supervenience, right? People will wonder, okay, but what is this supervenience? What is this dependence relation? And he's done some interesting work on this, kind of specifying three kinds of supervenience, all right? And I'll just make mention of each of these three, and he embraces the third.
Okay.
The first he calls reductive supervenience, and this is where something is identical to something else, right? So take moral goodness, right? Suppose someone says, well, God himself is moral goodness, right? Well, that would be this kind of reductive approach where you're affirming an identity. Okay, so that's supervenience where A just equals B.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so you might say, well, how is it that moral goodness depends on God? Well, you know, moral goodness just is God. You see,
yeah.
All right.
So and is it Robert Adams?
Robert Adams' view there, and you could give a naturalist variant too. If someone says, take Richard Boyd, one of the Cornell realists, who says there's some complex composition of natural properties. It's hard to know exactly what composition it is, but some composition or other of natural properties make up moral goodness, right? And there's an identity relation there.
Now, is that different than emergence? It seems like you've got these new novel properties that are not reducible to the physical natural properties that somehow emerge out of the physical, right?
The emergence is going to be more the picture that Weilenberg is going to paint,
okay.
I think.
All right.
Because this is not the emergence of a new property. This is an identity.
Okay.
Yeah, this is an identity. All right. Now, and I'm thinking I'm getting Boyd right on that issue, that he's more of an identity guy than an emergence guy.
Okay.
But maybe I'll double check on that to make sure I don't want to mislead. But Adams, for sure, in equating God with the good, would be an example.
All right.
So that's our supervenience for R for reductive. Okay. That's the terminology that Wielenberg likes to use there. The next one is named after Robert Adams himself, because in his book Finite and Infinite Goods, he says finite goods, unlike the infinite good which is God himself.
Right.
Finite goods, you know, like friendship, mm-hmm. are good in virtue of relevant resemblance of some aspect of God's nature, character, or something like that. And so he calls this, Wielenberg calls this Adam's supervenience, or a supervenience. And this is the idea that it's not, the finite goodness is not identical with the ultimate good,
right?
But there's some kind of, say, resemblance, relevant resemblance to something which exists necessarily. And like God exists necessarily, he's the ultimate good. To the extent that we resemble him, then we possess finite goodness. This is another kind of dependence relation. And again, this would be a supervenience. A supervenience. That's the name that Wielenberg likes to use.
So let me ask you, if we take that relation, in that case, human beings would have value by virtue of this supervenient relation to God. Is that right?
Let me think. The moral property of having value.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It would be parasitic on our relationship to God in one way or another.
Okay.
Right? And this is actually going to be a criticism that Wielenberg wishes to launch against Adams, against the later Murphy, and against Linda Zagzebski. Uh-huh. Because in each of those cases, the folks say, and Mark Linville, in each of these cases, the folks will say something like, well, look, human goodness or human value, human dignity are parasitic in one sense or another on God, depend on God.
Right.
And this precludes you from saying, so says Wielenberg, that human beings possess intrinsic dignity,
right?
It becomes, in a sense, extrinsic, because it's dependent on God. And Wielenberg is going to say, this is a criticism, because I can actually give you, on my view, an account of intrinsic human dignity that doesn't depend on something other than human beings themselves.
Okay.
Okay, so that's a good question. We'll get to that. And also try to reply to it, because as a theist, I'm inclined to resist him on that score, even though I think he's making a legitimate point in a real sense. The third sort of supervenience, though, he calls D supervenience, and he names it after a guy named De Paul, a contemporary philosopher who's written on the subject. And D supervenience is this idea of making. It's a making relation.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what Wielenberg's resistance to the other forms of supervenience are is that you could potentially just have a relationship of covariance without a real causal relationship obtaining. And he wants his supervenience account to be a substantive, robust causal relationship, where what he wants to say is the moral properties supervene on natural properties, in that the natural properties cause these moral properties to be instantiated, to come into existence.
Right.
This kind of thing, yeah.
How can, if the physical world is causing the moral world, basically, right? Is that a fair way of saying it?
Uh-huh.
But the physical world has no potential moral properties in itself, but somehow this physical configuration is causing moral properties that have no causal or explanatory power to give rise to the new moral properties.
Yeah. This is an interesting challenge that you're raising, and among other things, I think you're pointing to the sort of discontinuity that you're discerning exists, right, between the physical and the moral, right?
Right.
Yeah. That's going to be one of the criticisms that I raise, too.
Okay.
Interestingly, in his book, he answers the objection of someone who raises a discontinuity objection, and his answer kind of goes like this. Okay, here's what you're saying to me. If you have a theory where there's a causal relationship between things that are discontinuous, that counts against the theory. Well, my answer to that, this is Wielenberg talking, right?
Yeah.
Let me just paraphrase.
Right.
My answer to that is, What you're saying features things that are discontinuous and a presumed causal relation between them. The discontinuity between recognizing the existence of discontinuity and this inference that you're drawing that the theory in question is somehow, you know, fallible as a result. He says, well, that features discontinuity properties too. And so you're suggesting you have an intuition in one direction. I'm saying that intuition cuts both ways and works against your theory.
Okay. Well, see, I won't argue with that, but, I mean, my response to that would be that it seems like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the causal powers of the thing have to do with its nature, right? So this is like an Aristotelian view of metaphysics. And that you're telling me that the natural, the natural things that you were talking about don't have any kind of moral powers, yet they are realizing moral properties. So I don't think that I'm subject to that kind of criticism, because I'm saying the view of metaphysics I'm proposing is that causal powers have to do with the nature of a thing. You're telling me there's nothing in the physical thing that has to do with has any kind of moral properties.
Well, I think we need to disambiguate.
Okay.
When Wielenberg says that the physical properties don't have those latent moral properties,
yeah,
I don't think he's thereby committing himself or attempting at least forthrightly to deny this causation relationship. He
right.
does think that the physical properties will cause the moral properties.
Right. It seems like if the physical has the power to cause moral properties, that in the physical substance, you have to have the power to bring about the moral properties, right? That, therefore, in that case, there is, in a sense, something moral about the physical, namely that the power to bring about mental moral properties is in the physical.
On his view,
yeah,
the physical does have the power to bring about moral properties.
Okay.
Yes, that's true.
Right.
Now, interestingly, Wielenberg criticizes Linville. I mentioned him before.
Yeah.
You know, Linville takes on various secular ethical theories, and he says, you know, none of them can really do justice to this notion of human dignity and value and worth, as well as can theism, and particularly that aspect of theism according to which we've been made in God's image, we've been made, you know, after his likeness, and been imbued with value and dignity and all of this sort of stuff. And this is often given, you know, by theists as the best account of why it is that we possess intrinsic human, you know, dignity and worth.
Right.
Right now, I'm not so interested in defending that idea as just making mention of it, because Wielenberg is skeptical of this approach,
mm-hmm.
and one reason is because he thinks that this would make human dignity extrinsic to human nature rather than intrinsic.
Right, right.
Extrinsic in virtue of, say, having been created by God, or relevant resemblance to you know, God's nature, or something like that, right?
Right.
And so it becomes a less intrinsic and more extrinsic sort of approach. Our value and dignity would be derivable in some sense because of that relationship with God. But on Wielenberg's view, he's going to say something like human dignity, that moral property of human dignity, de-supervenes on being human.
Okay.
Right? And that there's just this direct, immediate, causal connection. So being human makes it the case that we possess such dignity.
Right.
I think this is what he would say, and he would say that this is the better account of intrinsic human dignity than anything the theist could provide.
Okay. Okay. Well, how would you reply to Wielenberg then?
Wielenberg's is a really interesting kind of approach, it seems to me, and so I think it's, you know, worthwhile to think about. I'd make a few points, I think. Beginning with this one, he wants to say that being human robustly causes the instantiation of our dignity, right? Okay. Well, an important question to ask, it seems to me, is, well, what is being human? You know, what is that? if he simply presupposes it to be a purely natural property, then it seems to me that he's potentially begging the question. He's just assuming naturalism or secularism or at least, you know, affirmation of causal closure or something like that, right? But what he's definitely ruling out is anything, it seems to me, that's like spiritual or, you know, related in some kind of necessary or essential way to God. This is question begging. It seems to me it's circular. I mean, who we are as human beings is the question.
Right.
Right? So part of the evidence that in need of explanation is human dignity.
Yeah.
So the question becomes, it seems to me, you know, what best explains the human dignity?
Right.
And at that point, that's where the abductive approach can really help.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's the first thing that I would say. It seems to me that he's potentially begging the question.
So by saying that humans, being human is natural property, this having this property entails or causes humans to have the moral property
causes.
Of being valued or having value.
Yeah.
Right. And so that is just question begging, you're saying.
Potentially question begging, yeah, seems to me. And you're right to use the word cause rather than entail, because again, an entailment, just like the weaker versions of supervenience, he points out, can potentially just bespeak covariance and not a robust causal relationship like desupervenience does. Okay, so that's one question. That's one sort of question that I would like to raise against his view. Another one. It seems to me that. Again, Wielenberg does not claim exactly to be a naturalist, but he does embrace the principle of causal closure, according to which everything in the physical world is caused to happen by something else in the physical world, right? And to the extent that there are any kind of moral properties, they're causally inert. They don't exert any kind of causal influence on the physical world. All right, now, that's not exactly naturalism, right? But he still wants to say, well, I agree with the naturalists about causal closure, so he really wants to kind of get pretty close to the naturalists, but then he wants to say he also believes in these moral properties that supervene in this particular sense on the physical world. Alright? But if you're going to talk about the existence of persons, right, we know that naturalists have a rather hard time accounting for the existence of persons from an ontological sort of perspective, right? If what we essentially are, you know, atoms and molecules arranged in particular ways and so forth, right? How is it that we have such a thing as human meaning, human dignity, human value, human worth, a human telos, right? Mm-hmm. Those things are notoriously hard to account for and accommodate within the bounds of naturalism. The book by R. Scott Smith, called In Search of Moral Knowledge, Overcoming the Fact-Value Dichotomy, is quite a big book in which he makes the case at great length, you know, that our naturalist friends are really hard-pressed to account for the existence of persons with the resources at their disposal as naturalists. And he takes someone like Daniel Dennett and his view of intentional systems and so forth as kind of an honest, paradigmatic way in which naturalists, if they're really forthright about the thing, you know, will acknowledge their grave difficulty in making sense of genuine human agency, genuine human persons, free will, all the kinds of things that we think make up our humanity. On a purely naturalistic system, this is very difficult to make sense of, you know, human essence, human telos, and so forth. Now, again, Wielenberg is not a pure naturalist,
right.
But by embracing causal closure, right, then it seems to me that all of the problems riddling naturalism are also going to riddle his overall view as well, and he's going to have a very hard time making sense of the existence of human personhood and such, and human essence, human telos, and these various other things that collectively constitute, you know, human meaning and dignity and value and such.
Well, couldn't you just say that human telos is a moral property and that it's caused by the physical human being in the same way that the, you know, other moral properties are caused?
I think it would be an interesting attempt, but I think that telos, I mean, what would be the corresponding physical property there, right? I mean, telos is we're talking about a final causation thing here. By embracing causal closure, I mean, he pretty much gives up final or formal causation, right? I mean, it becomes for him all about, you know, material and efficient causes and such.
Right.
So what physical property would correspond with something like a final cause when he's rejected the whole category?
But what physical property would correspond with any moral property, though, really?
Well, there's correspondence, I think, right, between the torturing of a child and its being wrong.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that by identifying the correspondence, you've identified the robust causal relation.
Right.
So, yeah, but you're right. There's the discontinuity challenge conjoined now with respect to the telos, with this sort of second order problem.
Yeah.
So, a third issue.
Yeah.
Okay. I made mention of the discontinuity problem. It seems to me that this isn't just a small leap that he's trying to make from the physical to the moral.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a vast chasm, and it features a qualitative gap,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not just a quantitative problem, right? You're going from something that's just, you know, atoms and molecules whizzing around and that sort of thing, right?
Right.
To these platonic properties, these moral properties, right?
Yeah.
And it just seems strange to in a real sense to believe that these things, without any kind of broader story to account for the causal connection, would just come into existence. I mean, what is it about the physical world? I mean, this is a large part, I think, of what you were trying to raise earlier as a concern. What is it about the physical world that has any kind of organic, you know, connection here that could cause these non-physical, you know, prescriptively binding moral values and duties and whatnot, to obtain? It's a very strange sense of discontinuity, it seems to me, a radical qualitative gap that exists between these very different sorts of properties. Is it possible? I mean, I would say it's epistemically possible in the sense that I don't know it's not the case, but I just don't see any compelling reason to think that he has provided us a good secular explanation of robust ethics simply by pointing to this seemingly remote kind of possibility.
Well, it seems like even if it were true that there was this causal relation, but the causal relation would need an explanation.
Yeah, right? And that's what I was suggesting, that at least without a broader story to make sense of it, you know, it seems to be odd to me. It seems to be odd. Now, by the way, I think that the reason why people would even consider this to be a plausible theory, one that they might, you know, embrace, is simply the fact that, you know, all of us would affirm, almost all of us would affirm without hesitation, look, that child's being tortured. That's wrong.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Of course, we assume it's wrong. Right.
Yeah.
And we tie it with wrongness. In our minds, you know, that connection exists. Right. But why does that connection exist? I mean, you might say it's something like general revelation, but if you actually look at, you know, the history of human civilization and all of the rest, it took us a long while to develop the moral commitments and convictions and intuitions and so forth that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the things that we used to think were kind of morally okay, you know, like treating people as slaves and such, you know, it took a long time for people to realize that wasn't right at all. This is really, really wrong.
Yeah.
You know, or the idea of human dignity itself, right? I mean, this wasn't always assumed to be the case. And of course, again, history is replete with examples of people who wanted to mistreat people. And to justify it, they simply denied the existence of their dignity and worth and so forth as human beings, or they denied their very humanity.
Right.
Right? This is not a small academic question, right? I mean, I don't want to be merely reliant on the goodwill of, you know, good atheists like Eric Weilenberg who say, well, I believe it. You know, I see the wrongness of this thing and so forth. Well, good. I'm glad you do. You know, and I think you're probably far better than your worldview in this respect. But there are plenty of people who would deny that this is the case, who would deny that people have, you know, dignity, certainly in the history of human civilization, but even now, you know. And I think this has huge implications for how it is that we're going to treat people, you know, from here on out. So the fact that we have had all of the influences that we have, religious and otherwise, to shape our moral convictions and intuitions the way they've been shaped, right, doesn't mean that this is forever going to remain the same, and that nobody's ever going to come along and say, you know what, I'm going to give this whole notion of human dignity up as a superstition, right? I mean, that is potentially a very real possibility. We've seen it happen before, and we could well see it again. And if you remove the truly adequate foundations of objective morality and replace it with something simply like this, which is, to me, I just think predicated on wishful thinking and a remotely possible causal connection, I think you're potentially, you know, going to run into that very problem.
Well, so it's not binding. So even if there are these Platonic moral properties, why should I care about them? Why should I be obligated by them? Is that the idea?
No, but that's another good question. Right? Yeah, even if there are those properties out there, you know, why should we care about them? That is another kind of question to ask, right? But you could be skeptical that there would even be those properties, you see? Right, and again, in this connection, can I read you a quote? This is it's a longer quote, but it's from David Bentley Hart, and I think it's very useful because, unlike Wielenberg, honestly, who I think was a terrific guy and a good philosopher, I think he's a little historically myopic on this, and I think David Bentley Hart is anything but historically myopic on these matters, and he basically warns against a sanguine assumption that human dignity will always continue to be assumed as sacrosanct. So here's the quote.
Okay.
And it's really, I think, kind of powerful. And people are inclined, are free to disagree, but I mean, you have to do a fair bit of historical work, it seems to me, to understand the issues at play here. So a little historical perspective. Here we go. The more vital and essential victory of Christianity lay in the strange, impractical, altogether unworldly tenderness of the moral intuitions it succeeded in sowing in human consciences. If we find ourselves occasionally shocked by how casually ancient men and women destroyed or ignored lives we would think ineffably precious, we would do well to reflect that theirs was, in purely pragmatic terms, a more natural disposition toward reality. It required an extraordinary moment of awakening in a few privileged souls, and then centuries of the relentless and total immersion of culture in the Christian story to make even the best of us conscious, or at least able to believe in, the moral claim of all other persons upon us, the splendor and irreducible dignity of the divine humanity within them, that depth within each of them that potentially touches upon the eternal. In the light of Christianity's absolute law of charity, we came to see what formerly we could not. The autistic or Down syndrome or otherwise disabled child, for instance, for whom the world can remain a perpetual perplexity, which can too often cause pain but perhaps only vaguely and fleetingly charm or delight, the derelict or wretched or broken man or woman who has wasted his or her life away, the homeless, the utterly impoverished, the diseased, the mentally ill, the physically disabled, exiles, refugees, fugitives, even criminals and reprobates. To reject, turn away from, or kill any or all of them would be, in a very real sense, the most purely practical of impulses. To be able, however, to see in them not only something of worth, but indeed something potentially godlike, to be cherished and adored, is the rarest and most ennoblingly unrealistic capacity ever bred within human souls. To look on the child, whom our ancient ancestors would have seen as somehow unwholesome or as a worthless burden, and would have abandoned to fate, and to see in him or her instead a person worthy of all affection, resplendent with divine glory, ominous with an absolute demand upon our consciences, evoking our love and our reverence, is to be set free from mere elemental existence and from those natural limitations that pre-Christian persons took to be the very definition of reality. And only someone profoundly ignorant of history and of native human inclinations could doubt that it is only as a consequence of the revolutionary force of Christianity within our history, within the very heart of our shared nature, that any of us can experience this freedom. We deceive ourselves also, however, if we doubt how very fragile this vision of things truly is, how elusive this truth that only charity can know, how easily forgotten this mystery that only charity can penetrate. Pretty powerful stuff there, it seems to me. And what Hart is suggesting is, you know, this casual assumption that, well, of course, we're all forever from now on going to continue to embrace human dignity and value and worth is potentially a huge mistake. There were reasons why we developed these convictions, and historically speaking, those reasons were very much tied to a Christian worldview, the belief that we've been made in God's image and by God for a reason, for a purpose. If you simply cut all that stuff away, it's likely that our culture will for a while continue to embrace those ideas, but can they really sustain them? Can they really sustain them? I entertain serious doubts that it can. See, oftentimes folks will say, look, maybe we did come up with the idea because of religion, but we can hold on to the idea now without it.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And maybe that's true in principle, right? But the thing is, my issue right now is simply it has to do with the epistemology of his view. Like how reasonable is his view? Okay?
Okay.
If that's all I have to go on, right? Well, you know,
yeah.
Don't you just see it? You know, there's this and then there's that, and yeah, it's a little mysterious, okay. But whatever. I don't need God. I mean, why couldn't someone simply say, I'm really unpersuaded by this. It seems to me you're simply beholden to a worldview that you've rejected, and you're just trying to hold on to this. That's often the criticism that gets raised. Anyway, I think it's a point worth making, the historical connection between these convictions and religion, not because it definitively answers the question, but because too many people simply dismiss it as irrelevant when it's not. The whole point of Hart's thing is, this was a profound cultural reformation, and you know that took place. It was very complicated. You know, people for centuries would live in a world in which people denied the dignity of others, or you know that children shouldn't be enslaved and whatever. You know what I mean? I mean these are crucial convictions to hold on to. And if Wielenberg wants to say, well, look, you know, I don't care where they came from historically. I just care about their truth, right?
Yeah.
I'm inclined to say, among other things, I don't particularly care that you believe these things. I want a theory that actually sustains them.
Right. And it makes them compelling.
Right.
Any other last criticisms you might want to mention about Wielenberg?
Yeah, I might just say a couple of things. You know, he's within his epistemic rights to hold such a view as this. Obviously right. enough, you know, I just don't happen to find it a very persuasive or compelling view. It's certainly not a stupid view or anything. I just think that theism is going to provide the better explanation of moral facts and moral truths and moral values, including something like human dignity. But yeah, I mean, there seem to be a number of problems with Wielenberg's view, at least so far as I'm able to get my mind around it. Again, I think he's altogether too sanguine in his affirmation of a human nature or essence on his worldview. Mm-hmm. I think that the distinctive features of morality produce a significant, you know, qualitative chasm between natural and moral facts. His view seems to be parsimonious as well, in a very significant sort of way. You know, I mean, there's this indulgent affirmation of the existence of these moral facts, but he's helping himself to these things. But it just doesn't seem principled enough to me. I mean, where would value come from non-value and so forth? It's not at all clear. And then, you know, he just kind of stops at a certain point in his explanation, and he says, look, all explanations have to come to an end. You know, you theists, you end with God, I end with this, mm-hmm. right? But I think God is a stopping point, is a much more natural stopping point, and leaves a whole lot less things unexplained. So his seems to me to be an unprincipled stopping point of explanation, which at the end of the day, amounts more to assertion than argument. And then beyond all of those things, again, I think there's this very significant, historically myopic treatment of the worldview as eliminable, the theistic worldview as eliminable, you know, yet we can still retain these firm moral convictions. I just think that's unrealistic and unwise, and I think the net effect is that Wielenberg's moral theory seems to contain, you know, very dim prospects indeed for undergirding something so fundamental and important as intrinsic human dignity and value. And again, I think the way he gets away with it is simply because ours is a culture that has been so influenced by theistic thought and by Christian teachings and so forth that many of these moral truths seem at this point to be non-negotiable and ineliminable, you know. But unless we remember that we need adequate metaphysical resources to undergird those truths, right, and remember the lessons from history, I think this is just a mistake and a potentially dangerous one.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Baggett, for that very insightful podcast. If you haven't had the chance, I encourage you to check out the website. We have two new features that started this week. The first is a series of letters from a mysterious Mr. Ichabod to his uncle Apollyon, which I think you'll find intriguing. And we also have a new mailbag feature where we're going to be answering questions that people send in to us. If you have a question, you can find our contact information on the website. You can also message us on Facebook if you'd like to do that. But as always, you know, we have content from philosophers, from biblical scholars, from poets, from literary scholars, from biblical scholars, from theologians. We have a wide array of content and something for everyone. So please check out the site, and we'll hope to see you back here again next week.